I'm starting now. So today I am will enter, I think, the most interesting part of the lecture, that, which is about the quantization of non-abelian gauge theories. So up to now, what we have been doing has been warm-up exercise, if you want, for the interesting theories for modern high-energy physics and a lot of other aspects of modern physics, like quantum gravity, some aspects of condensed matter physics, also in many areas of mathematics now, the quantum theory and non-abelian symmetries play an important role. Okay, so what are non-abelian gauge theories? They are, in some sense, a natural generalization of Maxwell's theory to symmetries, so symmetries carried by charges, carried by the fields, which are non-abelian, which are not just the U1 symmetry of the Maxwell field, but non-abelian symmetries mixing the fields, and therefore the symmetries will be carried by charges, but the gauge fields which mediate the interaction will also be charged. And so non-abelian gauge theories were, as far as I know, invented by Young and Mills around 54, I think, so a long time ago, before I was born. And they were invented in some sense for the wrong reason, because they were trying to build a theory of interaction for the weak interaction. It turns out that the electroweak interactions are also described by non-abelian gauge theories, but with the X sector, and nobody had the idea of the X sector, and of the symmetry breaking of gauge theory at that time. So they built a theory, but it was not working because they had massless particles. So this theory should have long-range interaction. And at that time, people knew that the weak interaction were described by the Fermi theory, which was a short-distance interaction with a short-range interaction. So this was forgotten or not pursued for a long time. And Young's theory turned out, in fact, to be the right theory to describe strong interactions. Okay. And at the same time, slightly before, they came back in the study of and the theory of weak interaction, but with more physics input, because people invented the X sector. So that's an idea that is often in theoretical physics. You are discovering the right object when looking in the wrong direction, or not exactly focused on the right direction. And for instance, gauge theories were invented to study, to model weak interaction, and they turned out to be the right object to model strong interaction, and then all the interaction. Slightly later, people started to look at what they called dual models to model strong interaction. And this turns out not to describe strong interaction, but led to string theory, and so it was it's a good tool to study gravitation, quantum gravity, okay, and so on. So there are many examples in physics where people discover things for the wrong reason. But so you should pursue your studies even if you think that it's not working very well, and that's okay. Okay, so now let us come back to the problem of gauge theory. So the idea is, instead of having, for instance, quantum fields with one charge, for instance, in the quantum electrodynamics, you have the fermion, the electron field. You may have so this is a fermion. You may have a scalar field. It will become the, so this can be a spin. A scalar, a spinor, and it is charged. So you have, in fact, two fields, because one and its complex conjugate. It has a two component to carry the degrees of freedom of charge. But you have only one charge, and this leads to a U1 group. So in QED, you have a U1 group of symmetry. Okay. So now the idea is, what happens if instead of having one charge, you have two charges, for instance, two charges. In that case, you need to have more degrees of freedom. So in fact, your field, you expect them that they will carry indices. So you have I equal 1 or 2, some quantum number, which describes what is the charge of the does this field describe a particle with the charge of the first type of the particle, the charge of the second type. Okay, and so you can build just two copies of quantum electrodynamics or scalar electrodynamics in the case of the scalar. But you want, in addition, to have more symmetries in your problem, and therefore you want to have a symmetry between the one and the two indices. So in fact, you want to have an SU2 symmetry, which means basically that if you take, for instance, a field psi high, and you change it into a unitary matrix U, a matrix U times psi I, where UIG, so this means taking UIG, where UIG is a unitary matrix, you want the physics to be invariant under this change. So you want to have one more symmetry.
Index on psi on the right hand side is
okay,
right?
Yes. So UIG psi G with the Einstein notation. Okay. So you want to have a mixing between the two fields in the same way that in fact by the U1 rotation, which you have a mixing which is the psi and its complex conjugate, because each field carry a real part and an imaginary part, and the U1 symmetry is just a rotation, a mixing. So you want to have a mixing in both in the direction of charge and in the direction of this quantum numbers, which we call color, for instance, color indices. And one wants to do the same thing that has been done for quantum for electromagnetism, electrodynamics, namely to build an interaction with interactions between those fields changing with those charge mediated by some vector bosons. So we need interactions. We want to look for interactions mediated by vector bosons. Okay? So we need to have a gauge field. Now we want to have a gauge field mu, which carries some interaction. So what has to be done in order to do that? In order to do that, the gauge field has to be related to the group of SU2. And in fact, the gauge field has to be taken as an element of what is called the Lie algebra of the gauge group. So let us explain what it is. So what we shall have to construct a gauge field depending on a set of gauge field, not only one gauge field, but a set of gauge field labeled by indices, where the indices A here will take three values, because this gauge field will belong to the algebra which generates the element of the SU2 group. So what is you have seen, I think, in the tutorial, what is the SU2 group? The SU2 group is a group of element G, which correspond to Hermitian, unitary matrices. So G equal G dagger. This 2 by 2 matrices. 2 by 2 matrices, complex. And in addition, you impose that the determinant of G is equal to 1. Okay? Pardon?
G inverse is G dagger.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. G inverse is G dagger, of course. Okay. And so these matrices you have seen can always be written as some exponential of I times some other matrix. I will call it alpha, where alpha is
has to satisfy alpha. So it's equal minus alpha dagger. So the alpha are anti-Hermitian traceless matrices.
Anti-Hermitian traceless.
Oh
yes, there is an I. So yeah, I'm sorry. There is an I. So that's anti-Hermitian traceless. Okay. And those matrices, therefore, belongs to so alpha belongs to what is noted often the same thing, but with little letter SU2, which is the Lie algebra of SU2. Okay, so the Lie algebra of SU2 is the algebra of Hermitian traceless matrices. And Hermitian traceless matrices may be generated easily out of, for instance, the Pauli matrices. So you can, in fact, write that an alpha matrix belonging to this. So this is a matrix, a 2x2 matrix, can be always written as, and let us take this, 1/2 sigma, I'm sorry, alpha A. Let us write it this way. Alpha, it can be written in terms of, on a basis where the TA are just, TA form a basis of the algebra of the algebra of SU2. It means it's a set of generator of SU2. And one can take for the SU2, for instance, 1/2 of the sigma A, where the sigma A are the Pauli matrices. Okay. And now this Lie algebra carry a very important structure, which is called the Lie bracket. The Lie bracket is, in that case, it corresponds just to the commutator. So you take two elements of the algebra, two matrices, and you take the commutator, and you can check that it's still an Hermitian traceless matrix. And therefore, it's an operation which is anti-symmetric. And in particular, if you know what is the Lie bracket between the generator, you know all the what is the Lie bracket for all the algebra. Well, for a matrix, you can compute it directly, but in general, you have this. And with my notation, A, B, in general, of course, the Lie bracket of two generators of the algebra can be expressed as a linear combination of the generator of the algebra. And therefore, you can be written as I times some three index tensor, A, B, C, T, C. I am summing over the C's. Okay? The AB refers to which Lie bracket I am taking. And the FABC are called the structure constant. Structure constant of the algebra. Okay. And of course, in the case of Pauli matrices, and it is in this case of this representation of the Lie algebra of SU2, the FABC are just the fully antisymmetric symbol, epsilon ABC, which is epsilon ABC is zero if some of the E's are equal, and they are equal of one plus or minus one, depending on the signature of the permutation, which maps 1, 2, 3 into ABC. So this is plus the famous anti-symmetric symbol. You know very well that from the theory of the group of rotation and the representation of the group of rotation. Okay? So now what's important to know is that, in fact, this structure is very general and is it exists for any group which is called the Lie group, which is basically any group which is continuous, which in which you can write an element as an exponential or something. There corresponds a Lie algebra, because basically the Lie algebra contains information about the non-commutativity of the group. Basically, I have no time to explain, but so it's something which is defined for any group. independently of the way this group is represented. You don't need to know that the SU2 group is represented as a group of matrix, because that's a representation of the group. This structure is characteristic of the group considered as an abstract object. Okay, so that, yes?
The mu is, if you take it is for 1, 2, 3, are they not supposed to be 4?
Pardon?
The mu, are they not supposed to be 4? Are they 3?
Are there?
3 of these elements in mu.
Yeah, so I will come back to the case of, we'll describe them later. But basically, you see that in the case of SU2 group, the Lie algebra, so the number of independent matrices you need to generate all the elements of G is 3. So it means that what is called the dimension of the group, SU2, is 3. It means that the group of SU2 is a space with a three-dimensional curved manifold. It's a three-dimensional space. Okay. Okay. So now, and so why do we need to consider a field which is like that? That's because in order to realize this symmetry, you see, it's natural to define a gauge transformation for the group SU2 as starting from the, for instance, let's start from our fermionic field, phi I of x. Of course, it carries some, if it's a fermion, it will carry some spinor in, index, but I don't worry about that for the moment. So let us take, for instance, that psi is a scalar field. Then what I want to a gauge transformation will be a transformation of the following form. It will be a transformation of the form exponential of I times this matrix. Alpha A. Now, this matrix alpha, let us write it as alpha A TA. So this is a matrix acting on this index space A times psi A of A, psi A of X. Okay? So here I can take as a TA precisely the generator of the SU2 group, namely the matrices which are proportional to 1/2 times the Pauli matrices. But in fact, in general, you may take TA which are related to the T, but which do not belong to the space. So in general, you can take as the PIs belonging to a representation of the group. Okay? And in that case, the matrix I here, so let us call this representation R, and the matrix here R are some matrix, so they are a set of three matrix acting in some space, complex or real space with some with a dimension which is not necessarily equal to 2. And the only things that we need to have is that the commutator for the generator of this transformation. So we need that the commutator TAR TBR obeys to the same commutation relation with the same structure constant than the Lie bracket for the group. That's all what we need. Okay. So in the case I'm considering here, in the case I am considering here, I started from, the matter field carry as many indices as the space in which, with respect to which the group is defined. Thank you. So this means that, in fact, I'm considering here if I equal 1, 2, and is a complex field, I'm considering the fact that the matter fields belong which what is called the fundamental representation. Fundamental representation of the group SU2. And that's a simple case, and that's the case we need in most cases. But in the theory of ground unified interaction and in the electro weak model in general, you have to consider fields, matter fields, which belong to more general representation. Namely, this means that the matter field may carry a set of charge. The ice labels, remember, the index ice labels the number of I goes from 1 to 2. So these are what are called the color indices. So they carry the number of different charges of the theory. And a matter field may carry one charge, but it may carry two charges, three charges. It may carry a combination of charges. It can be a complicated object. And in that case, it corresponds to matter field which belong to higher representation of the gauge symmetric group. Okay? So now, So if we have a theory where the matter field just satisfied is invariant under this kind of transformation for an alpha A, which is independent of X, we have what is called the global transformation. So if the gauge transformation, and let us call it, I will take now an infinitesimal transformation. So I consider that psi I goes to psi I plus I alpha A T A R, which is a matrix IG TG. This is called a rigid or global symmetry. Okay? So now, what one would like to construct is a theory where we have an invariance where alpha becomes alpha of X. So if alpha is an alpha of X, which depends on the position of space, this will be a gauge symmetry. Yes?
Do you mean TJ or psi j?
Oh, psi j. Of course. So then we'll have a local. We want to promote this global symmetry into a local gauge, the principle of local gauge invariance. Because this is up to now the only way that has been found to build a quantum theory which mediates interaction carried by the charge field, which is mediated by spin one bosons. That we want that for explaining the world around. So what we have to do then is that, of course, in the same way that we did for the Maxwell symmetry, we want to introduce a gauge field, which will be a vector field. So A mu, and this A mu will depend on the indices of the, there will be as many as mu as there are generators of the group. So A goes from 1, 2, 3. Okay?
And that's the color index?
No, the color index are the eyes. And this is an index which is related to what is called the rank of the group. Pardon?
Introducing this gauge field to maintain local gauge invariance?
Yeah, we have to introduce the gauge field in order to, not to maintain, because we had no gauge, but in order to build a theory which has a local gauge invariance. Okay? There is nothing wrong in having a theory with a global symmetry. but this theory is not very interesting.
It's interesting for many aspects, but it's not very interesting. Okay. So then what we have to do, of course, is that we want to define a covariant derivative in the same way that we have seen that in order to have in the Maxwell theory, in the same way that in order to we had to change the ordinary derivative which appears in the Lagrangian for the Dirac theory into a covariant derivative, we need a notion of covariant derivative. So we need for derivative into covariant derivative. And the good notion for covariant derivative is the following. We shall define what is the covariant derivative of the field as so that which is defined in the following way. So the action of the covariant derivative is different when acting on the matter field and when acting on the gauge field or on the gauge transformation parameter, you see. So what is the covariant derivative? The covariant derivative is simply defined as, let us first see what is the covariant derivative acting on a gauge parameter alpha. And this will be simply d mu alpha of x, the ordinary derivative, minus I times the bracket between a of x and alpha of x. Okay, what does it mean? It means that, remember that alpha of x, so the what is alpha of x? I write that a generator of a local Ganges invariance alpha of x is simply an element of the D algebra, so in fact it's a set of field alpha of x times the generator TA of the Lie algebra. So it's a 2 by 2 matrix. A 2 by 2. Pardon? Why? No. Let me see. The same way, I will try to adapt compact notation because it's very important to have the same here. So there is a mu, but there is an a. So in the same way, I define a mu of x as a combination of. So I have three vector fields, and out of that, I construct a vector field which is a field in the space of Hermitian traceless matrices. I call it a mu. So this is a matrix. This is a scalar. Well, this is a vector. This is a vector and a matrix in the same way here. And so I define in a global way what is the covariant derivative acting on A by this operation. So you see, it's the ordinary derivative, and then there is a commutator. In the same way, I can define what is the covariant derivative of the field A nu of x as d mu A nu of x, the gauge field, minus I, the commutator of A mu of x with A nu of x. Okay? And this term is new because SU2 is non-abelian. You know, you can write the same object for U1, for the Maxwell field, but in the Maxwell field, you have only one field. So
So the field is not a matrix. And of course, the commutator is a commutator of one field with itself, which makes zero. One by one matrix always commute, but two by two matrix do not always commute. So this is a term which is new. And if you want to write it in terms of the component of A, of course, what does this give? Remember that the commutator, you can write it in terms of component, in terms of the structure constant. And then this becomes simply that d mu of alpha A of x is d mu of alpha A of x minus, this becomes a plus because there is minus I here and here there is an I. So this becomes, do I really have an I? Yes. This plus G times F A B C A mu B of X alpha C of X. So you see the covariant derivative is a term which is non-linear. This is the structure constant which are constant, and this term is a combination of two of the field of the theory. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry, there is no G. I'm sorry. There was a G. For the moment, I have no coupling constant. I have no charge. I have not specified what are the charge. There is no E, if you want. I have not specified the charge carried by the field. We'll see that the charge will come at once when we define what is the action for the theory. Therefore, what is the dynamics of the theory? For the moment, I'm just looking at the symmetry. I'm looking at the cinematics of the theory. And okay. So in the same way, we can write the same thing for d mu and u. And now we can define. So this is what is called the covariant derivative. And this is what is. And we shall define what is the stress tensor. What is the f mu nu field? Is there a way to define an f mu nu field in a nice way? Okay. Well, there is a simple way. You have to take simply as we shall define the f mu nu field as I will divide in a bit abstract way. I define it as the commutator between the covariant derivative d mu and the covariant derivative d nu. And the commutator between those two operators, you see. So those two operators, so this, a priori, you may expect that it contains operator involving two derivatives, operator involving one derivative, and functions of the field. It turns out that all the derivatives cancel by symmetry, and you end up with an expression for f mu nu, which is that f mu nu of x is equal to, where do I have the expression? It's simply d mu a nu of x minus d nu a nu of x. That's the original formula for the we had in the Maxwell theory. But of course, there is now a new term which comes from the commutator. And this new term is plus it's minus I with my notation, I think, a mu of x, a nu of x. The commutator, or the Lie bracket, or the two elements. So let us, this is a compact notation. And what does it give in terms of components? So in terms of the three components of the tensor field, it gives us that. So remember, A mu is a field which has three components. The three components of Hermitian traceless matrices. So f mu nu, which is an action of object acting in this space, has three components. So f mu nu carries also three components. F mu nu x is d mu a nu a of x minus d mu a nu a of x, and then plus, and if I am right, it's f a b c a mu b of x a nu c of x. So now you see that the electromagnetic, the analog of the electromagnetic tensor, contains not only derivative of fields, but a term which is non-linear because it involves the product of two fields in a combination which depend on the symmetry structure of the group. You see? Okay. And now, yes?
Actually, two questions. One is that commutator of covariant derivatives acting upon something?
Yes.
Should there be an A in there for it to act upon?
No. I'm defining, this is an operator acting on, for instance, on alpha fields. Okay?
Right.
Okay, on alpha fields. So a priori, it contains a term which contains derivative of, well, it may contain term containing two derivatives of alpha. But those terms cancel because it's a commutator. It may contain term containing one derivative of alpha, but it appears that those terms disappear. So it remains only alpha times a multiplication by something. And this is a function. See? So you may take the definition of f mu nu, you may take it as defined by this object. Okay? If you prefer, take the definition of f mu nu as given by this object. Okay? But it has a geometrical interpretation in terms of this, because in general, commutator of derivative are related with what is called curvature. Tensor. Okay. Remember that, for instance, in general relativity, the Riemann curvature tensor, in fact, is given by the derivative of covariant objects in on a curved space. So, for instance, this means in general relativity, if you take you are on a curved space, and you make parallel transform in one direction. Parallel transform in the second direction, parallel transform, you come back. So in general, you have, when doing that, in fact, you have computed the commutator of two covariant derivatives in two directions. And you get something which is not a differential operator, but just some kind of rotation acting in the space of tangent vectors. This is the Riemann curvature tensor. The Riemann curvature tensor corresponds to this. So the stress tensor in gauge theories correspond to the curvature tensor in the space of configuration of gauge field. Yes?
In the definition for covariant derivatives, if you reduce the case to a
yes.
Would the commutator vanish?
Of course, because remember, this A is this A is a matrix. It carries three indices. So this is a commutator between matrices. And this is in each component of the matrix, this is the term. In the case of the U1 gauge field, you have only one field, A equal 1.
I mean, in the definition for covariant derivative.
So in the definition for covariant derivative, this term disappears because the commutator of two functions, of two numbers, is always 0. Okay?
Well, in the Abelian case, F goes to
you can write that, but you don't. In the Abelian case, you have A equal 1. You know, the only possible value for the index A is 1. Okay? And so, can you define a structure constant in the case when A is only one value? You can only define F 1, 1, 1. You see? But the FABC has many properties. First, FABC is antisymmetric. That's a general property because it corresponds to taking commutator. Second, it satisfies the set of identities which are called Jacobi identities. I have no time to explain that, but it corresponds simply to the, it's the consequence for the structure constant of the fact that if you take three matrices and you take their commutator, if you make you know, shifts in, this is always zero for commutator. So this is always zero for commutator, but this is always zero for Lie brackets. You know, that's, in fact, that's the definition of Lie algebra. A Lie algebra is an algebra with a bracket which satisfies this Jacobi identity. And this gives you strong constraint on the FABC. But in fact, if you are in the abelian case, you have only one FF. F111, but this cannot be anti-symmetric in the indices, but except if F is zero. So you see, so this term is automatically zero, this term is automatically zero, this term is automatically zero in the case of U1 theory. But in the case of an SU2 theory, you must have this term if you want to have an SU2 symmetry. Okay? Good. So, okay, so now what is the effect? Now let us come back to the fact that we want to make a gauge transformation on the field. Okay, so with this definition, what is if I made a gauge transformation, we have seen already what is the effect of a gauge transformation of A mu. It means that I'm changing, I am changing the gauge field and the gauge matter by some transformation generated by some alpha A of X. So I made a gauge transformation generated by some alpha of X. Remember, alpha of X is alpha A of X TA. So in fact, it's a matrix. Okay? Now, so we have seen what was the generator of the gauge transformation on psi. The generator of the gauge transformation of psi was psi goes to psi I plus I alpha A T A R I G of psi G, where T A R was the matrix of the representation of the Lie algebra in the space. So the TAR are just, in that case, the TA for the adjoint representation. For the fundamental representation, the TAR are just 1/2 times the Pauli matrices. But it may be different. Now, what are the effect of making a gauge transformation on the gauge field? Remember, in the case of the Abelian gauge field, the gauge transformation was by definition taking the derivative of the generator of the gauge transformation. For non-Abelian field, this d mu is not very nice. So in fact, the correct definition is to replace it by the covariant derivative of d mu. But remember that the covariant derivative of d mu depends on a mu. So this is a transformation which starts to be more complicated because it depends on a mu. You see? It's not just a global shift in a mu. It's a shift which depends on the value of the field. So the gauge transformation now depends both on space, but on the value of the field itself, of the gauge field. So it's much more complicated than in the case of Abelian gauge theories. Okay? Now, what are the properties of the gauge transformation? One nice property is that the gauge, if you make a gauge transformation on a covariant derivative of a matter field, you get where the covariant derivative in the matter field is defined exactly in the same way by taking the TAR is,
the covariant derivative of the matter field is 1 plus I alpha A. Oh, I have it's also TARIG times the covariant derivative of psi G. Let us say delta IG. So in fact, the nice properties of covariant derivative is that covariant derivative are gauge covariant. You know, if you make a gauge transformation on the covariant derivative of the field, you get, what do you get? You get the gauge transformation of the covariant derivative of the field. So in some sense, covariant derivative commutes which gets transformation. You see? If I change psi into psi plus this, and I take its covariant derivative, I take, so if I take the covariant derivative of a gauge transform field, I get the gauge transform of the covariant derivative. Okay? And in the same way, what is, if I take f mu nu, so f mu nu depends on A. Okay? Yes?
On the covariant derivative,
yes.
Where is the I on the left? It looks like I is a free index.
I'm sorry. This I, usually I have two I's. When I have an I in the formula, it's square root of minus
one. Phi I.
Yes.
Pardon?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a phi I. This is a I. This is a color index. This is the color index, I, delta IG, IG, psi I, and this I is, of course, square root of minus 1.
Okay.
So sometimes it's an derivative. Okay. So now, what is the effect of the, what is the effect of a gauge transformation onto the stress sensor itself? Well, it occurs that this is F mu nu plus I times the commutator of alpha with F mu nu. Remember, alpha is an element in the matrix, F mu nu is the matrix, so you can take the commutator or the B bracket. So in fact, this is also, this means that the stress tensor, the tensor is also covariant under gauge transformation. It transforms as it should under gauge transformation. And so there is no derivative of d mu, so it means that you see, it doesn't depend on the alpha dependence, but there is still a little term generated, which means that there is a phase. Remember now? Okay, so this is nice because this means that everything, d mu, f mu nu, etc., have well-defined properties, well-defined transformation properties under gauge transformation. Okay? So you see here, for instance, there is a term which is not there in the case of the U1 theory, but this term will not be dangerous because it's a commutator. Okay. So once we have done that, we are almost done because now we can define as the gauge theory. We can take simply as an action for the gauge theory. For Popo, I will keep that here because that's important to get the idea. What is the action for gauge theory that we can take? What is the natural action for gauge theories? Natural action. Natural action for gauge theories. Well, it's very simple. Simply, so we'd like to take as an action just the same action than for the electromagnetic field. So we would like to take the square of the stress tensor. Okay? But now you have to be a little bit careful because remember, F mu nu, in fact, is a set of
belongs to the Lie algebra of the group, so it's a traceless symmetric matrix. Okay, and each component of this matrix is given by this formula. So this is a matrix. This is a product of two matrix, so it's a matrix. So in order to have a number, what we would like to take is to take the trace of this matrix. Trace of this matrix. What does it mean to take the trace? It means to take simply that. That will be the action for the Young and Phi. To take the trace means that I know that F mu nu is F mu nu A times T A. And therefore, the trace means I'm taking the sum of, I'm taking the trace of F mu nu A F mu nu B. Well, this times the trace of T A T B. Okay, but here, for instance, the TA and the TBs are one half of Pauli matrices. And it turns out, in general, it's always the case, but this is just delta AB. So what we are, I'm summing over A and B. This means the trace of that. So in fact, I'm taking this means that in general, I'm taking the sum over each component of the stress tensor, F mu nu A, F mu nu A. So I am summing both over the mu's and the nu's and all the three possible components of the stress tensor. Okay. So you see, it's just a generalization of the electromagnetic field. And now if you want to couple this to the fermions, for example, for the matter, well, same game. What you expect is that you have, for instance, for the fermions, an I, d slash minus m of psi, okay? Where now you have to remember that the psi's carry, the psi's and the psi bar carry both color indices and Dirac indices. This is Dirac, this is color indices. This is the ordinary, this is the covariant derivative which carries out color, which carries out color indices because I write it here. And you have a D slash because you have gamma matrices which take care of the Dirac indices and you have to be a little bit careful. But this is basically the same formula. And when I will describe what are the Feynman rules for the propagator for this theory, I will see that in the morning. OK? Yes?
A one half or a one quarter in the Engels action.
That was a one quarter, as you do. Yes.
Okay. Only a half, and then it's the it's only normalized to a half, isn't it?
For the sigma A, yes, you are probably. I don't remember exactly. Let me. I have a one half here. Yeah, perhaps it's one half. Yeah. Or two. Well, it depends on the definition of the normalization. So I think with this choice of the T's to be the one half of the. Of the gamma matrices, this ends up with the right coefficient here. Okay? But I have to check. Okay. So now, you remember, where is the charge now? Where is the charge of the particle? You have a freedom here in the action because you can normalize this coefficient in a different way. So here I will introduce. What is the coupling constant of the theory as G squared here? So G is the coupling constant of the theory. So it measures the elementary charge of the theory, you see. If G is small, basically the F mu nu has to be small in order for this term to be small. This means that there are no fluctuations of the gauge field, and the particle
the matter is not coupled. So in fact, G measures the strength of the interaction. And if you change A mu into G A mu by this transformation, then of course what you get is that you get a factor, let us say, G here. Each time that you have a mu, you have a G. So you have G here, you have a G here, you have a G here, you have a G here because you have 2G instead of 1G. The covariant derivative for fermions in particular becomes contains. So you see that the definition of the covariant derivative contains a coupling constant in front of each coupling of A with the fields. So this means that the fields carry a charge G. But there is only one way to write a coupling constant here, because this term is unique. So in fact, there is only one charge possible, possible for all the fields. Okay. Yes. Pardon? This one respects the symmetry of the theory, the SU2 symmetry we started from. Okay. So if you want to have the SU2 symmetry and the symmetry over Lorentz transformation, then that's the only choice you have. Okay. All right. I'm going quite slow. Okay. So now, finally, in fact, I realize that I have not written exactly what was, it's very important, what was the covariant derivative for the spin-off fields. But in fact, the covariant derivative for the spin-off fields is defined in the same way as the covariant derivative for the gauge field. So it will contain the gauge field and an FAB. I will come to that later. So now let me concentrate on this term of the action. Okay, so let me concentrate on the gauge part of the theory, because it contains already a lot of interesting physics. Okay. So the gauge part of the let us write me the term F mu nu. So let me write minus 1/2 of trace of F mu nu, F mu nu. Okay. And I will write it in a slightly shortened notations. Because you see that F mu nu contains a term which is linear in A and a term which involves two couplings. You see? So in fact, this term contains a term of order which contains dA minus dA. Well, I write it in a very shorthanded notation. But no, I can do that. F mu mu A squared. OK, and that's the original Maxwell term for the fields. So you see, you have the first term is just the Maxwell term, so it seems that the excitation of the field are just, you have A photons. So you have A equal 1, 2, 3 different photons. Okay? With the same dynamics as that of the Maxwell field. But now you have these terms. And these terms give you two terms. Well, there is a minus 1/2, of course. Then you get a minus 1/2 times a factor 2, so that's a minus 1/2, times d mu a nu minus d mu a mu a, times these terms, f a b c, a mu b, a nu c. And you have complete constant here G, because I have made this rescaling. And then I have the square of those two products, which gives you a minus G squared over 4 FABCFADE, and then MUBANUC, MUD, ANUE. Okay? So you see immediately that you have now nonlinear term which describes the interaction between 3 gauge bosons and 4 gauge bosons. You see? If you want to construct the rules of Feynman diagrams, you see that you have a propagator for the gauge fields which carry those two indices A and A, which is basically that it will be the photon propagator. So the propagator for the gauge field will be the same as the propagator for the photon, except that now you have 3 different kinds of photons. So the photons carry some charge. But now you have an interaction term, which I will not write at that moment, but which tells you that 3 photons, 3 gauge bosons may interact with an interaction term which is proportional. So it contains some complicated term involving the derivative, but it contains a term proportional to FABC. So this term is non-zero because the group is non-abelian. So I get something which is proportional to FABC. And then some more complicated dependence on the mu nu, because remember, the gauge field contains Lorentz indices. So this is a mu nu. Remember, the gauge field carries both a Lorentz index and a gauge index. So you have a complicated vertex, and you have, in addition, a vertex which involves the interaction of 4 photons, A mu, B nu, C rho, and D delta, if you want, or index like that, and with the interaction which is proportional to the products of some products of the two structure content. So this is the gauge theory. So SU2 gauge theory is an interacting nonlinear theory of vector bosons. And the fact that the theory is interacting and the form of the interaction is dictated by the symmetry, the local symmetry of the interaction. You see, so you have no choice for the kind of interaction you may have. Yes?
Are you just to check, are you multiplying in by 1 over g squared when you're in this trace?
Yes, what I have been computing is this, by considering that A is changed to g a mu. So here I'm with this definition, I'm considering that G A mu is G times this plus this times G squared. Okay, make everything consistent. Okay, so you see that gauge theories that are in complicated nonlinear theory, but all the interactions are dictated by the symmetry group. Okay. So, and now if you, well, you can write also the Feynman diagram for the matter fields, and there is a coupling, which basically the coupling between the matter fields, so for instance the fermions and the gauge field will be exactly the same than for the case of quantum electrodynamics. So the new terms are the terms coming from this term, the interacting terms for the gauge fields. Okay, so now, how can we do quantization? Quantization. one expects problem in quantization because, remember, in the case of quantum electrodynamics or pure Maxwell theory, we have seen that in general, you know, the propagator of the photon has physical modes, the transverse modes, the transverse polarization modes, and it has unphysical modes that appears when you perform the quantization. I gave an example of procedure of quantization by using this Feynman-Landau tip gauge. And we saw that there were, in the spectrum of the theory, you know, in the Hilbert space of the theory we are constructed by Aoul, there were unphysical states which are problematic. But those physical states are decoupled in the Maxwell theory because it's a free theory. So if you start from physical fields, you get out with physical fields. The fields do not interact. Here you also have, we still have physical and physical states for exactly the same reason. But now these states interact. And if you look at how those states interact, you discover that it's very well possible that if you come with one gauge field which is physical, you may come out with two gauge fields which are unphysical. And here it's even worse. So the problem is that now those physical and unphysical states interact. Because the form of the interaction is fixed by the gauge field. Okay? And that's a big problem, and it prevented, it's one of the reasons why it took many years for people to build out a consistent gauge theory consistent quantum theory of non-abelian gauge theory. And in fact, it's even only in the beginning of the 70s, and Toft and Veltman and Jean Justin and some other people came out with proper receipts to quantize those theory. And to show that the theory was renormalizable. Because of its, this problem is a non-trivial one. Okay, yes?
For unphysical states for non-abelian gauge theory, does that mean negative norm?
They will. For instance, when you compute amplitudes, well, I won't have time to discuss, but when you compute amplitudes, for instance, when you compute the propagator of one photon, you know, compute the propagator of one photon, in quantum electrodynamics, you have the propagator, but you may have a loop of electron. Okay. But this loop of electron is harmless. You come with a physical photon, you get out with the physical state of the photon. In the gauge theory, you have a diagram like that, where now this is a photon, this is a photon. And you have also a diagram like that, which looks a bit like the tadpole diagram we have been considering in the 5-4 theory. And if you take into account this diagram and this diagram, you discover that they give the non-physical states contribution in those intermediate states do not cancel. And you get out something which is, in general, you get a result with, for instance, negative probabilities. Or you can get, in more general case, like a diagram like that. Okay. You may come out with physical state and have incoming physical state and get out with unphysical states. Things like that, in general. It's not only it's possible, but if you do the calculation using those naive rules and those vertex and just treating the propagator as a propagator of the gauge field, for the Maxwell field, you get out with problem like that. So in order to solve the problem, you have to treat into account the gauge fixing in a proper way. And when you do the gauge fixing in the proper way, you see that if you do gauge fixing consistently using the Fadeyev-Popov procedure, you discover that in fact, there are new interacting terms generated by the gauge fixing, which cancel those ones. And that's what I was planning to explain, but this will be a little short. So let us me just explain very shortly how one performs the gauge transformation. Okay, where is it? It's here. So I will see both why there is a problem and how this problem may be solved. Okay? So let us perform a gauge fixing like in the U1 theory. So I would like to have, so remember that I had those gauge transformation, which is that a gauge transformation of A mu is a changing A mu in A mu plus A mu times alpha. Okay, so there was a commutator plus d mu of alpha. This is a general gauge transformation. And this is A mu plus d mu of A, A the alpha, the original derivative, plus, if I'm right, A mu alpha. There was perhaps an I, I'm not sure. No, that's okay. There is a minus I. Okay, so you see that the gauge transformation contains depends on A mu. So now let us impose a Lorentz-like gauge fixing by imposing that, as usual, d mu of A mu equal omega. Okay? Remember that, in fact, A mu is a matrix. So this means that I'm imposing d mu A mu A equal omega A. I am imposing, instead of one gauge condition, 1, 2, 3, I'm imposing 3 gauge conditions, one for each component of the gauge field. Okay? And remember that, so this will be the function, the gauge. So I will have now 3 gauge condition, gauge fixing condition, which are that GA of A of X is defined as D mu A mu A minus omega A of X. Okay, so this is my definition. Okay. Now remember that now that in the in my procedure, I showed that if I start from an integral, a functional integral, so I start from a functional integral, when I want to integrate over all gauge field configuration, I have to do the gauge fixing by writing this as a term which is the volume of the gauge group times an integral over d A mu a delta function, which gives me the constraint by the gauge fixing, times a Fadeyev-Popov determinant, and what is this Fadeyev-Popov determinant? This matrix here, the Fadeyev-Popov operator, was in general defined as the functional derivative with respect to a gauge transformation. So this means that, in fact, this is, remember that this is GA. So you have, this is a matrix, in fact. This Fadeyev-Popov determinant is a big matrix. So it's some kind of big matrix, FP. It depends on X and Y, and it depends on A and B, because here I have one index for each of the gauge fixing condition, and one index for each of the alpha A gauge transformation. Okay, so this is a kernel whose elements are 3 by 3 matrices. But what was this kernel? This kernel was defined precisely by the
the derivative of the gauge fixing condition when I am making a gauge transformation. So how does this gauge fixing condition vary when I am making a gauge transformation? It's easy to compute. Remember, this is the variation of A. So what is the variation of dGA of A? This is simply d mu of the scalar derivative of the covariant derivative of A mu A. Okay? You see? But remember that d mu now is a matrix, so it's remember that d mu is d mu AB is delta AB times the ordinary derivative plus FABC A mu of C written in that way. So you see that now this, you must take the derivative, the functional determinant of an operator, which is this operator, d mu, d mu. This is the ordinary operator we had in the Maxwell case, plus delta AB, plus FABC, d mu, A mu C. So now the Fadeyev-Popov determinants depends on the gauge field configuration. Yes?
In the expression of delta A, shouldn't it be alpha instead of A mu C?
Where? Which one?
The
oh yes, I'm sorry. That's d mu. Alpha. Yeah, it's if you change the delta, this is delta AB. Yes, I'm sorry. So this is how, if I make a gauge transformation by a factor delta alpha here, which means that it's a small delta alpha, this is how the gauge fixing condition changes. Yes?
In your FP determinant here,
yes,
you've got something with a free index of nu being added to something with no free.
Mu are the Lorentz indices, and that's okay. So, and these are the color, the index of the generator of the group. So you see that now you have. Pardon?
Should that be GA or GA minus omega? Which one?
Well, this delta function means simply that I'm enforcing this gauge fixing condition at each point of space. GA of A mu A minus W.
So why does the delta function have a W in it as well?
Pardon?
Why does the delta function have a W? GA already has a W in it.
So why is it? Well, GA has this.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. You define G A. Oh, I am sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. G A depends on omega. So let us write this in the table as D mu A minus omega. Okay. Okay. So you see that now, and that's the difference in the abelian case. Non-abelian implies the Fadeyev-Popov determinant depends on the gauge field. Okay? So that's something new compared to the Maxwell theory. And this means that you have to take into account this dependence on the Fadeyev-Popov determinant when writing the Feynman rules for your theory or when quantizing your theory in a perturbative or in a non-perturbative way. You cannot just change, add the ordinary interaction vertices to the usual Maxwell theory. You have to take into account this new term. Okay? And that's what I'm going to explain shortly next time. I have to compute the determinant, and there is a beautiful trick due to Fadiev and Popov, which we remember. You have to remember that the determinant of some operator can always be written as some integral of something like that. OC in general, where C and C bar are Grassmann variables. You can always write a determinant as a Grassmann integral of an exponential of a quadratic form involving this operator and those Grassmann fields. And so what Fadiev and Popov have been doing, and the other people, have been to introduce what is called ghost field, which are, in fact, so we see that we will introduce fields which are scalars, but which are fermions next time, which allows to quantize this theory and to treat this complicated term exactly on the same footing as the gauge field. And this will lead to a consistent quantization procedure for the non-abelian gauge theory. And those are called the Fadiev-Popov ghosts. Okay, so I am going to do that next time, but I want you to remember already that the new things with non-abelian gauge theory is that the gauge fixing term coming from the gauge fixing introduce a new term which is not present in ordinary abelian theories. So not only it introduces new interaction term in the action, so not only the gauge fields becomes the gauge vectors fields become interacting, but the gauge fixing become much more involved because it depends on the gauge fixing the gauge field configuration. Okay? Well, thank you.